Good evening from WUKY 91.3 in Lexington, Kentucky. I'm Julie Rinn, and this is the Kentucky Women Writers Radio Hour. Some of you know me as director of the Kentucky Women Writers Conference. Last year, because of the pandemic, we did some things differently. We held our conference online, and instead of hosting a preview party, we did a radio show. It was so much fun to put that together that we're doing it again in 2021. And thanks to the good folks at WUKY, we hope to bring you a new episode every couple of months. Tonight, I'm joined by Randy Ewing from our board of directors. Hello, Randy.
Hello, Julie. It's good to be here. I think this radio show is one of the nice things, one of maybe the only nice things that's come out of the past year. So thanks.
Yes. So the Kentucky Women Writers Conference is the longest running event of its kind in the nation. It has happened every year without interruption since 1979, a place where women's voices and the craft of creative writing are taught and celebrated. Randy, you played a huge role in reinventing the conference last year for a virtual format. What was that like for you as our board president, figuring out how to hold such a complicated multi-day event entirely online?
Well, it's certainly hard to plan anything in times like these that are so full of uncertainty. And we made our decision as a board pretty early last year after the initial shutdown, deciding that it was good to have time to plan and learn the technology. And so that was kind of our first hurdle, was just how to move into a totally different medium and format. And we received a lot of help from the University of Kentucky College of Arts and Sciences, learning about Zoom and what we could do with that platform. And were we going to be able to like have writing workshops? Were we going to be able to have writers give readings and give talks and still feel the sense of community that we normally do? And I think, you know, we did a good job setting that up. And once you get it set up, you just have to trust the links, trust that they'll work, trust that people will show up. But I also think that we've all learned to be more patient this year, and any glitches, and we only had a few of them, but any of those small technological difficulties that we had were met with a lot of grace and humor. And that is also important in setting up any kind of a writing community, right? Writing, like everything else, requires not taking ourselves too seriously, being able to laugh at things, being able to see where we can make changes and adjustments. And I think we learned a lot, but we had a really successful conference. We did end up having that community.
We did, yeah. And some people attended for the first time who would not otherwise have been able to attend because of the travel distance or the expense. So we actually had a really great turnout. It was a new chapter in our long history. And so this year, we'll host our 43rd annual conference on September 9 through 12. Randy, if you could make a guess, do you think we'll be in person or online?
Well, gosh, certainly we would love to be back in the beautiful Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning in downtown Lexington. It has long been the home of the conference, and it is a wonderful venue for women's words. That said, it's probably too early to be able to count on an in-person conference right now. And even our best guess is kind of dependent on just so many factors. Everything is moving very quickly and very slowly at the same time, I believe. So I think we may be online again this year. And if we are, I'm confident that we'll be able to kind of create that safe community that supports and fosters women readers and writers. And like last year, as you said, the kind of the silver lining is that we'll be able to open our virtual doors to women who might not otherwise be able to attend.
Yes, but it sure will be great to be in person again someday. Yeah. Hopefully sooner rather than later. So tonight, Randy and I will be speaking with two authors who are participating in the September conference. And because our first episode of the Kentucky Women Writers Radio Hour last summer focused on fiction and nonfiction, tonight we want to focus on poetry. Women poets have been in the news lately in some really exciting ways. First, the American poet Louise Glück was named the 2020 Nobel Prize winner in poetry. It was the first time an American woman won this award since Toni Morrison in 1993. The Kentucky Women Writers Conference brought Louise Glück to Lexington way back in 2005, and I still remember her mesmerizing reading at the Lexington Public Library downtown, next to that big pendulum. Also, our country heard a pretty incredible poem last month on Inauguration Day. Randy, you teach high school English. Have your students been talking about Amanda Gorman and her poem, The Hill We Climb?
I think everybody's been talking about Gorman's poem, my students included. They were pretty taken with her poise and presentation. But you know, for those of us who make our livelihoods reading and writing and teaching words, I don't think it's surprising that a poet stole the show at the inauguration. I think certainly after the past year, this country is in need of healing, and all of us who spend our time with words understand the power of words to be a tonic and a balm, even as they're speaking truth to power. So, you know, we get a great dose of that every year with our Wild Woman of Poetry showcase. And it's a good reminder and a powerful thing to kind of hear that coming, especially from someone so young, and kind of the future of our country.
Yeah. And, you know, writing a poem for an occasion known as occasional poetry is really tough. And sometimes you can end up with something really mediocre. But, you know, Amanda Gorman, boy, did she just knock it out of the park with that. So it was a great moment for poetry, for women writers, and for spoken word, which I think is the tradition of poetry that she has come up in. So anyway, so stay tuned. And after the break, I will begin our interviews with the Louisville poet, Joy Priest. This is WUKY 91.3, and I'm Julie Rinn. You are listening to the Kentucky Women Writers Radio Hour. Our first guest today is the Afro-Latchan poet and essayist, Joy Priest. Joy grew up in Louisville and is currently a doctoral student at the University of Houston. Her first poetry collection, Horsepower, was published in 2020, and many of its poems have appeared in prestigious journals and anthologies. She formerly worked as a journalist, theater attendant, waitress, and fast food worker in Kentucky. Joy has also facilitated writing workshops and arbitration programs with adult and juvenile incarcerated women. Welcome, Joy.
Hi, it's good to see you, Julie.
So when I first met you about 10 years ago, you were in the orbit of Bianca Lynn Spriggs, who founded and ran our Wild Women of Poetry Slam for many years. Did you have an official role in those events? I can't remember.
This is so full circle because I'm probably the age now that Bianca was then. And I was just like, you know, an undergrad, like really just became kind of like an understudy to her. And I just sort of ran around behind her and just did whatever she asked me to do. So I had various roles in different things. I don't know if I had like an official role. She let me host some after party for the conference once, I believe. So,
well, that's really a great testament to, you know, the mentorship that goes on in our writing community around here. Because I remembered your name, and then I was so excited when I read in Poets and Writers magazine about a year ago that you had won the prestigious Donald Hall Prize for Poetry and that your first collection would be published by University of Pittsburgh Press. What was that like, hearing that news?
It was, you know, not that I don't think that I'm super talented, but it was really unexpected, mostly because I had only, you know, there's a handful of first book prizes. I applied to maybe like 6 or 7. And I had just got my first rejection from National Poetry Series right before that. And that's the one I really wanted. I have this sort of pattern in life where I really want something. I don't get that. But then I end up getting something just as great that I didn't anticipate. And so the second call I got about the manuscript was the Donna Hall Prize. And it made sense, and it was also just wild because of the judge, Natasha Trethewey, is just someone who I honestly only applied to the award because she was judging. I felt she could see my work, and it was someone who I consider to be in my literary lineage. But it also was surprising because it wasn't just the first book prize. It was like an any book prize. So the manuscript was up against, you know, writers who had already had two or three books. So it was just really cool. I got the news while I was at home in Kentucky. So that was also really great.
And Natasha Trethewey, of course, was she our poet laureate for a while, U.S. poet laureate?
Yeah, she was a U.S. poet laureate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she spoke at the Kentucky Women Writers Conference in 2008 and was awesome. So I can imagine how that must have just made it all the more thrilling for you.
Yeah, it was, amazing.
So this collection, as well as its first poem, are entitled Horsepower. And I'm wondering if you would start us off by reading that first poem.
Yeah, sure. This is the last poem I finished for the book, and thus came from it the title, Horsepower. Off season, before the racetrack opens, I jump through the threshold of my back door stable side. A dove takes off from its nest tucked into the corner of the porch awning, glides through my world, which I can see in its entirety from my top step. The twin steeples and emerald roofs just past our garage, a horse practicing its start out of the gate. Only Longfield, that avenue rounding the perimeter of the pill-shaped track where the red and white and green flags ripple from balconies, and my neighbors sell horchata in styrofoam cups, street tacos in paper baskets with cilantro and lime. Only Longfield and a chain link fence separates the horse's air from mine. They work the loop of that circular mile, making everyone's living except their own, the motors of our economy. Beyond the spires is a larger world I do not know exists. A mile west in my line of vision is a family I do not know I have. In that corner of the city, separating from the land like a cell in mitosis, straining across the Ohio River to the north, my great aunt, black matriarch, rocks on her blue porch, and my father, just a couple of blocks away from her, coos my baby brother into sleep while his new wife flowers the wings of a flightless bird. But all I know for now is my grandfather, the white one. And I know my mother, who I can hear now roaring home from work in her muscle car. And wait, I know the horses and the restless minds.
I think it's so interesting that you wrote that poem last. I guess it just really illustrates a process that a lot of writers experience where you don't really know how to give a prologue to something until you've written it. And then you can go back and introduce it. And I just feel like this poem gives such a sweeping view of all the ground that you're going to cover throughout the rest of the book.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to remember in detail, but I think, you know, my mentor for 10 years now, who I met as a student at University of Kentucky, and who ended up being my thesis director, Nikki Finney, she was just asking me questions at the time. It was like late in the manuscript, and she was, you know, asking me a lot of questions about frame, like what frame of the camera we were in, what view, perspective, the geography of the world I built and everything. And so I think I was trying to write sort of a map of everything. And it just contained all of the major themes. And I realized they all resonated with this concept of horsepower. So I was like, oh, that's the title.
It's a really cool concept. My first thought when I heard the title of this collection, knowing that you were from Louisville, home of the Kentucky Derby, was that the automotive term horsepower would be used metaphorically to talk about horses. And it is. But there are also an awful lot of cars in these poems. Can you talk about why certain cars have poetic resonance for you?
Yeah, so horsepower, it it is an automotive term. I was even thinking more broadly than that. I was thinking about the working class themes in the book and how horsepower is this unit of measurement of energy, of power that powers industrial machines. So I was thinking, you know, in that vein too, I was thinking about the horses. I was thinking about horsepower as this mental fortitude that the speaker has throughout the collection. But yes, cars are like a definitely a feature, a recurring feature in the book. I like sort of these classic old school cars, which I think are a big, I'm trying to think of the word, it's not feature, but just sort of, you know, a staple of the South, of like Southern culture, I think. You know, go far back in my memory. I mean, as a little kid, there was always like two or three muscle cars in the carport that my grandfather was working on, or my mother had a Cutlass Supreme Classic when I was growing up. She had a GTO at one point. So I just really love them. And I, you know, my first car, which I have a poem about, was a 1988 Cutlass Supreme Classic. And I don't know, they just popped up a lot. It was sort of a thing of self-discovery for me, where I realized like, oh, like I've always had a thing for cars as I was writing the book, so.
My first car was a 1986 Cutlass Sierra. So I know that sort of feeling of, it's almost like riding in a boat more than a car.
Yeah, it's the rear wheel drive, yeah.
So I was hoping you could read one of the poems where cars play a starring role. There's several of them.
Yeah. I think that and those mostly populate the last section, which doesn't really get a lot of attention. So I appreciate you asking me to read one of those. I'll do God of the Motorcade 2005, because, you know, they're like the known popular traditions of Derby, but a lot of the poems in this book are about sort of celebrating the peripheral traditions of the backside of the track, but also West Louisville, Black Louisville. And God of the Motorcade is a poem about this tradition we had in West Louisville of cruising on Derby weekend, where they would shut off Broadway from like 9th Street down all the way down to through the West End, and people would just cruise and grill and all kind of stuff. So God of the Motorcade 2005. In Louisville, from a sidewalk turned sideline on West Broadway, I catch my beloved, absent for weeks now, leading a cortege of Chevelles through the chaos of revelers, as earlier that day children led their handmade floats around a grade school derby parade. As he comes toward me, so too does a throat dark woman carrying past the scent of coconut. Her naked breast glistens slick as the skin of his convertible coupe. My eyes lit up at him know why he chooses this very spot to turn the chain of revving beasts through a slow U. Picture Dignan at New Year, now his headlights flooding across my red velour rockaway dress. And for a moment, you can see I am the one. Rumor has it the beast's weakness is an aversion to loud noises, fear of the color red. We are all too familiar with this combination, myths that we are, even this night on the main thoroughfare of River City, splitting our side in two, a few of us will become legend. I hear a girl say, there he is, my lover, who is also her lover, I see. I watch a boy dance with sharp and ancient movements to Lil Boosie on the roof of an old Buick. Someone daddy calling out red bone to me from behind a pit thick with smoke and the end of an animal. The tail of the monster that keeps him from me always out of reach whips away and evanesces at the bend on 18th Street.
Thank you. That was really wonderful. Joy, your father appears in several of these poems, and we can tell that the relationship was complex. Would you like to say more about that or read one of those poems about him?
Sure. I was talking to my workshop instructor recently because when people talk about poems, they tend to like use the conventions of metaphor. So she gave me a good way to like sort of reinforce that it's the father in the book, right? the assumed personal, as Sharon Olds talks about, the assumed father, the father is assumed to be mine. But so I just say that to reinforce that it's not completely autobiographical. You know, some of this is created, imagined, and works for the purposes of the story, but not necessarily the factual. It's not like journalism, you know.
Yeah, no, that's an important distinction. Oh, I'm glad you mentioned that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The speaker, I actually named the speaker in the second poem in the collection. I named her Sparkle. So Sparkle's father. My father teaches me how to slip away with Clarence Carter on in the background. And there I sit in my mother's white Plymouth, stolen in the open under advisement of this country's laws and customs. I wait beneath the Hollywood video's fanatic purple lights, their appliance buzz sound of the spectral past crackling in and out. I wait for my mother to return, to go back to the only home I've ever known. But inside, she's been stunned still at the sight of my father, possibly a mirage. I must have been asking for him, begging, but she had no address, no number to call. This moment, pure chance, a warp in the spinning wax come back around, her mind skipping as she stands before him with West Side Story in hand, then speaks finally to tell him I am out in the car. And that night, my father will tell his wife I exist. And that night, he'll make it to my grandfather's house with his declaration on his lips. He'll try even again after being turned away for 7 years by a many-chambered gun. In this time when he arrives, somehow my mother knows he is there waiting in the outer space air of October. This time a window is open and ash is falling from his cigarette behind the barbecue pit where he crouches just as the nightmare curls back from my skin like smoke. This time my grandfather is unaware, bound to his makeshift couch bed by malignancy when my mother pulls me through the cone of light cast from his living room and toward my black life. When we steal past the safe that holds the revolver wrapped in a tea towel, my free fist turns like a wrench in my eye, and then the heavy oak door whispered open by the sparkle of my father's knuckles, and then my mother pushing me onto the night porch saying, "Your father, this is your father. Before me, a mirror. My horse mind flickers. When I step into him and look back at my mother, she is on the other side."
Thank you. So you earned an MFA in creative writing from the University of South Carolina, which I think of as the school that Nikki Finney left us for. She used to teach at University of Kentucky and of course is now at South Carolina. Mm-hmm. And in fact, she was just inducted into the Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame last week. Can you talk a little bit more about her influence on your work?
It's probably like some long form essay or book maybe that'll get written later in life. I mean, you know, it's just really been a special relationship in my life. I mean, I don't know how many writers these days sort of have that classic like apprentice, you know, relationship with an older member of their craft. But you know, I first took a workshop with her. I guess when I was maybe 20, undergrad at UK. And it was a fiction workshop. And then after that, I took poetry workshops and I did her summer writing retreat at Hyman. And it just took everything she taught. And I went off into the world, went to New York and stuff. And then, you know, called her up and I decided to go to South Carolina to do the MFA where I worked on the manuscript. And it was just really the best thing I could have done because to have someone who was there at the beginning of this project that you were working on and then, you know, gets to see it through to the end. You know, her hand is real heavy on it. So yeah, I mean, she's just like my mother in writing, and her and Crystal Wilkinson are, you know, like my mom and my poetry auntie, you know.
That's been an enduring theme of the Kentucky Women Writers Conference. And we hosted Nikki, I think it was in 2009, and she did a reading with Holly Goddard Jones, a Kentucky fiction writer who viewed Nikki as a key mentor. So it's not just poets that really look to Nikki for inspiration. I mean, she's had a hand in so many so many writers' lives. So she's very deserving of being in our state's Hall of Fame. So I'm really excited that that happened.
You know, it's not, Nikki is like the main star of my mentee life, but it's also like the first reader I remember hearing at the Kentucky Women Writers Conference was Ada Limon. And she and Rebecca Gilhowe have been really, you know, supportive in my writing career. They actually called me year before last to tell me I got the Fine Arts Work Center Fellowship that they both had in Provincetown, Massachusetts. And so there's just so many, you know, it makes me feel like writing, like women writers in Kentucky make me feel like writing is a legacy that's not talked about as much as like bourbon and basketball and horses, but it's so thick, you know, the legacy and the writing family is thick. So
that's, I love the way you put that. That's so true. I mean, I've witnessed it for, you know, all the years I've lived in the States. So so I did want to mention that I thought it was probably hugely disappointing to have your book launch in 2020 during the pandemic. But we can't wait to host you at the Kentucky Women Writers Conference to help you extend that launch well into 2021. We're really excited that you're going to join us in September and, you know, just look forward to hearing more from you.
I'm really excited to be doing the conference. I'm hoping that, we're hearing this news about end of the summer vaccinations, so maybe it'll be in person. But if not, I'm so excited to join you all.
Well, either way, we'll have the conference in person or online, so it's definitely going to happen. Thank you so much, Joy.
Thank you, Julie.
This is WUKY 91.3, and I'm Julie Rinn. You're listening to the Kentucky Women Writers Radio Hour. Next, we'll hear from Randy Ewing speaking with the poet Linnell Edwards.
Hi, I'm Randy Ewing, a member of the board of the Kentucky Women Writers Conference, and I am here today talking with Linnell Edwards. Linnell is a poet living and writing in Louisville, Kentucky, where she is the Associate Programs Director for the Spalding School of Creative and Professional Writing. She's the author of 4 previous poetry collections, and today we'll be talking about her most recent collection, This Great Green Valley. Hello, Linnell, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and thanks to the Kentucky Women Writers Conference for including me in this segment.
We're so excited to have you. And I'd like, if we can, to just start with you giving us a little introduction to This Great Green Valley and kind of the content and resources you worked with in this writing process.
Sure. So this was a really fun project for me. I had done a little research with some of the source material for this book, and maybe I should back up by saying the book's first half chronicles narratives and history of Kentucky's pioneer days, basically what's considered the pre-statehood period, which would stop at 1792, when Kentucky was granted statehood. So the period from about 1760 to 1792, where I had a little bit of genealogical history that I knew about and had always known about with some of my early family into Kentucky. And I wrote one poem about this time period, just kind of poking around for material and ideas and kind of had an idea. And I wrote one poem. And then I did a little bit more. My son was actually working on a genealogy project about the McAfee brothers whose stories are threaded through here. And I was looking at some of his material. And this is now going to sound like the mysterious process of poetry writing. I heard very clearly their voices in a first person plural way. I did not hear the brothers, their 4 or 5 brothers and a family. I did not hear individual brothers, but I heard very strongly their voice in a kind of we poem. And I wrote one poem, and I've sort of surprised myself. And I realized, I think there's more here to this. And so I was granted the great gift of a sabbatical in the spring of 2018. And I proposed that I would work at the Filson Historical Society, where I knew there would be a lot of primary research and a lot of good research on the McAfee brothers, on Kentucky's early history from the 18th century, as well as reports of it in the 19th century. And so I was able to sort of ensconce myself down there in the spring of 2018 and have this amazing luxury of working with the incredible archive staff there to just bring me stuff, and I could see what it was going to be about. And because I lived in Louisville, the Filson hosts scholars from all over, and they come in for a week only of intensive research, but I had the luxury of being there. And so I just explored, and I looked up documents and primary documents, and did other reading about the pioneer history. And what became pretty quickly apparent was that what you read about in 19th century and even slightly later accounts of the Kentucky pioneers was not quite the same story that you got from the primary documents in the 18th century. And so in this space, I realized in this, it was kind of an imaginative space between what you see in the primary documents and what the 19th century had decided history would be about. Right. And so that's where the poems speak from. I don't know that revisionist history is exactly what it is, because in some ways I think all histories are revisions of what really happened. But I'm working in that space between the reality of the primary documents, letters and journals and maps and things, and what the 19th century said retroactively to kind of validate what the state became. So that's a little bit about that. I think I'll go ahead and read the one poem that I think this poem particularly speaks to that. So the poems in the first section of the book are poems about the pioneer history, and there are poems about the McAfee brothers and their voice, but there are also poems that do this same work of retelling very well-known stories from Kentucky history, or well-known stories if you grow up in Kentucky in some ways, about Daniel Boone. And in this case, there's a fairly famous story about how Daniel Boone's daughter and two of her friends are kidnapped by natives and taken away, and Daniel Boone and the boyfriends and the fathers go roaring after them and heroically rescue them and bring them back. And it's a story of bravery and all kinds of things that are also wrapped in up into it as a kind of tradition of captivity narratives. So I imagined, well, what did their mothers think? Mm-hmm. And it very quickly, even though I don't have girls, it very quickly spoke to me as one of those stories where your child has done something so extraordinarily both dangerous and foolish that when they get back, you want to hug them and slap them at the same time. Like, don't you ever do that. And so this is called "The Mothers of Elizabeth and Francis Calloway and Jemima Boone Embraced Them Upon Their Return from Captive by Indians, July 17th, 1776. How pressed by the heat were you that you thought it safe to wander toward river's bank, there to launch our light canoe, dare each other to tip it? How enchanted, laughing at your game, that you didn't hear the savage on his path? Haven't we always, always warned you with one ear toward the meadow's edge and one ear toward the station bell to bend? And how long do you suppose he and his band lay at their leisure watching you, watching the laces loose at your breast, your hair tumbled from its cap in the heat? Do not protest that you were clever as woodsmen to snap twigs, leave your marks of ripped hem, ribbon. Do not think it but God's providence what saved you. These boys, these yet smooth-skinned boys, hot warriors in pursuit of their beloveds, as though they yet know what love might suffer. To rescue their maids, so they flew, and so too your fathers, their eyes blurred with rage and fear, did follow. Do not think you were other still than foolish girls, even as you have had your trial, your three-day tramp through this desolate wild, even as you, Elizabeth, countenance grown dark from the sun, eye and cheekbone shadowed in fatigue, a red kerchief wrapped like a primitive crown around your brow. So but a father's hand, such a beloved, would have cleaved your skull, thinking you a long-haired, savage, unholy creature meant to ruin his maid." So the great fear with captivity was that for young women, they would be defiled. They weren't. And also much anxiety about children, particularly taken by natives and then going native and not coming back. And there's quite a lot of anxiety about that. That's a kind of race-based anxiety that's based in this case with the native tribes and the white settlers. And that comes out in that as well. Where the father thinks that actually they're so fast and furious with their you know, guns and so forth that they think one of the girls is actually one of the Indians.
Oh, okay. Well, one of the things that strikes me about this is that this is, you've chosen to write in the mother's voices, as you said, and that is another, you know, that women were also left out of this settler's history in a lot of ways. And so, you know, throughout the collection, I felt like the poems were in conversation with one another, kind of confirming and challenging each other's memories. I mean, I'm interested to hear you speak a little bit about the tension between the history as it's been recorded and the alternate stories of that time, and how you as a poet approached and potentially made use of that tension. You talked about that as the kind of like this space, this gulf that existed.
Right. So this imaginative space, one of the things in using the McAfee brothers was that I had a relatively blank slate to kind of work on. Mostly people don't know about the McAfee brothers. They're sort of the second tier of famous Kentuckians in history. So if you start writing about Daniel Boone, then everybody's got their idea of what Daniel Boone is and was and did and so forth. But you start talking to the McAfee brothers and nobody has any idea. So I had a kind of blank canvas on which to write and draw, not exactly anything I wanted, but to imagine their voices and to imagine their concerns. When you start talking about better known voices, again, it's you step into contested ground. Tell me your question again. Just rephrase one more.
I'm interested in how then those different pieces begin to speak to each other inside of the collection, because they, in a way, they're kind of challenging and confirming these different points of view. Whereas when we get like a piece of history that's written down in a text, right. We don't always get those voices. So this collection then, to me, becomes very much a conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, the 19th century narratives that came down were interested in a couple things, chiefly validating the order that did emerge.
Right.
So one of the things about the pioneer as a very fluid space is that not everything was sort of set down and defined. So it wasn't clear what was going to happen as a result of various treaties with Native American tribes. It wasn't clear that Kentucky was going to be a slave state. Because there was a church presence, there wasn't an obvious plantation crop, it wasn't really clear. It wasn't clear who was going to have sort of dibs on the vote, generally. Kentucky, I think, was the first state to have, this is going to sound like a paradox, universal suffrage for white men, but what I mean is that Kentucky, you didn't have to own land and property. All the white men could vote. So when the 19th century starts to retell these stories, things that have to not be so, you know, have to emerge, have to show that, well, you know, the stories about the native tribes, for instance, have to show sort of pleasant Indians and a domestication of that presence, rather than showing them for, in the early part of Kentucky settlement, say, what I would call the worthy foes that the Native Americans were. And that's part of that is kind of tacking between, as you're saying, sort of tacking between what was received about the story. And in the story, for instance, of the rescue of Daniel Boone's daughter and her friends, you know, the story comes down and says, he's heroic, they've been captured. And it's just more complicated than that as to what might've happened and what the girls were doing, you know, and why they were out. And also what their fears really were.
And so I think, you know, you've made use of persona in a lot of these pieces, but then you've also used ekphrasis at times. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to ask you to read another poem, Heroic Deeds of Former Times, Colonel Benjamin Logan Saving Harrison from Being Scalped, and then to talk a little bit about that process.
Yeah. So the poems, as probably our listeners are surmising, are very expository. They just say what's happening here. And this was a painted representation of an event, May 30th, 1777, that was done in the 19th century, 1850, that depicts exactly what the series says. It's a series of four paintings that are depicting heroic deeds of former times, pioneer times. And they're really kind of wacky depictions. And they do depict these famous scenes. Another one is the one in the book about the women at the Fort of Bryan Station going out and getting water for the fort. And they're kind of wacky because there's some things wrong in the painting to the time period and the place period. And those will come out in the poem. And they don't necessarily depict the scene of chaos that might have happened. And also in this particular story, the painting sort of I think I'll read the poem and then I'll talk about it. It'll make more sense because I obviously can't hold up a picture of a painting on the radio. So it'll make more sense if I read the poem. Okay. So again, Heroic Deeds of Former Times, Colonel Benjamin Logan Saving Harrison from Being Scalped, May 30th, 1777. After G.W. Faisal, circa 1850. In this depiction, no sign of the woman who won't stop screaming, the man hissing it foolishness to open the gate, no sign of milk spilled from the pails, last hope of staying the siege, no dark woods near, dense with hardwoods. Instead, Hudson Valley landscape serene. The warriors are cartoon ghouls, naked and painted, war bonnets wrong. One, a gleeful satyr, carves the scalp from a kneeling settler. Mid-frame, the mild cows stare complacent, waiting for their tenders to return. And Logan, upright, his man hefted over one shoulder and with noble disdain at the heathen chaos, strides toward the station unscathed. No sign of him creeping behind the bag of wool rolled out for cover. The station in flames, Harrison already dead. So in the depiction of this, Logan has saved the man. He doesn't get scalped. It's weird. This is a fort attack, and there's like a cow just hanging out in the middle of the painting that doesn't move. The Indians are wrong. They had the wrong kind of headdress. And Logan, of course, looks triumphantly heroic. He's like, you know, brawny at like the cover.
I looked the picture up, actually. Because I was curious. And yeah, he's like carrying a man like a bag of flour, like it's no problem. And I, you know, you say in here cartoon ghouls, it does feel like a caricature in some ways, not like a
It's a strange thing because the actual primary accounts are, and of course you can imagine the scene of the chaos, which is chaos, like. They're in panic mode. Nobody wants to open the door to go get the dead guy. He's already dead. And Harrison or Logan creeps out behind like a sack of wool. So he's down on the ground and you can imagine, and there's a woman, you know, there's always, of course, in the movies, this woman who won't stop screaming, right? She's just hysterical. And everything's burning. And this depiction suggests, you know, an otherworldly heroism out of Logan and a kind of impossible scene. But for the 19th century telling of what happened, that's important.
Sure.
The other poem is in some ways the same way.
Yeah, and so this, I kind of think of this as almost as a reverse ekphrastic poem in a way. Can you explain ekphrasis? Briefly to the audience.
Ekphrastic poetry takes as its starting off point a piece of visual art. It could be a photograph, it could be a sculpture, it could be architecture. It's most commonly painting, a painting like this. One way to think about it is that it continues the conversation a painting or a piece of visual art starts. In this case, I'm doing something slightly different, although I think the painting was done to memorialize the event. And so the painter would hope, hanging in the gallery in 1850, people would remember how brave the pioneers were and how ghoulish the natives were. And so it hoped to start that conversation. For us, it should start a different conversation of, is this really what happened? Is this what it was like? And my answer as a poet is, nope, I think it was different. And this is how I think it was different.
Yeah. Well, so I think that leads us then to the final poem in the first section, which as the boy grows, so grows the tale, which I'd love to hear you read and then talk a little bit about why you chose to kind of end the section with that particular piece.
Yeah, this was another story that I read in several places about a little boy, and the poem will explain it, who gets lost, like really lost, because he wanders away too far because there's danger. And it gets a little bit at this fear too, that the people on the in the pioneer settlements would become too wild themselves. You know, my friend Kiki Petrosina writes a lot about this time period in Jeffersonian on the Eastern Seaboard. And when you think about and we've talked a little bit about what's going on in, say, Virginia compared to the frontier of Kentucky. And in Virginia in the 18th century, you know, it looks like the 18th century. It looks like, you know, almost London or something. Mm-hmm. And in Kentucky, it's craziness, just utter dirt floor pioneer craziness. And so people were worried that they'd lose their civilized self. So as the boy grows, so grows the tale. How he had heard the gunshots on a warm afternoon while he and his friends foraged for chestnuts far from the station. How fearing attack, they scattered like minnows. How he didn't stop running until he was nigh lost, and with dark creeping in, called and called, but never heard his fellow's hurrah, nor his father's high whistle. How he crawled into a hollow log, moss pulled up for a blanket, and how he slept that night, and the next night, and then 10 nights, wandering from rock house to root, to smooth bank of a creek bed, nose to chest like a fox or a bobcat, gathering herbs and leaves, tiny bitter berries, what sustenance might carry him one day more, how he caught a glittering fish with his bare hands, but twisting so, it cut him, and he threw it back, and how he was never, ever afraid. He will say to his grandsons, wide-eyed on the rug, mug of milk in their hands, never afraid, not even when he saw two bright eyes shining from a tangle of laurel. Was it a bear, he will ask them, drawing closer, or an Indian? And the boys will cry out when he laughs, their hearts beating like birds, startled at the wild thing he had once become. So this closes a section because it happens two generations almost after the end of the pioneer days. So if the story happens in 1785 or so, this happens when the boy is 10 and now he's 75. This is 60 years later that puts us squarely into the rewriting of the pioneer histories.
Well, and what I like about it as an end to this section for me is that it kind of, there's a commentary to some extent on what comes before it and on the idea that, like, as time goes by, the tale grows, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, was it a bear or an Indian? Like this, it kind of has that idea of like, all of this is tales of some sort. The painting, yeah. The, you know, our history, it's the tale of the settler. It's the tale of the colonizer. It's the tale of the one who won. And so this, I think, is a nice little nod to that too, you know?
Thank you. I'm glad you get that from it. And I do like this poem. And part of it is because I am a mother of boys. So I also like very much this little character that popped out in several different accounts I read of this too. I think of him as a 10-year-old boy out there trying to eat berries and catch a fish with his hand.
And very much like in the tradition of the Lost Boys, right?
Yeah.
Like, it feels,
yes, and then
feels
he would become
way.
Wild. He would lose his civilization and he would become wild and therefore, I guess, damned.
Yeah. Well, finally, I'd love for you to talk a little bit about the second part of the book, which is called Locking Through, and how it works in concert with the first part of the book. How are those working together? And why did you decide to include it and end the book with it?
This is a poem I've been working on for a long time, and it's longer. It runs about 9 or 10 pages. And I had started working on it one time. I drove over the Kentucky River there on 64 from Louisville to Lexington, and I looked down at the river, and I thought that. And those lines, the very first lines of the poem, still and flat as a summer days, the Kentucky River below Tyrone Bridge fills now beneath its green surface with salt and scree from the Palisades. That image of the river, it's like, wow, you know, I got this gift of a line. And I wrote a lot of poems, and this poem used to be lots of smaller poems, and then I made it a big poem, and I didn't know what to do with it. And I realized when I got through the big, you know, the collection of poems for the pioneers, that I really needed something more to make it a book. And so I realized that from a thinking about sort of the spirit of place, that this poem goes with it. This is the story of the people who lived much, much, much later, basically in this same place. To get down in the weeds on Central Kentucky geography, where I'm talking about in Lawrenceburg, by the river is very, very close to where the Kentucky River is as it goes kind of up against Mercer County and where the McAfee brothers were in Central Kentucky. So it's very, very close. It's a longer drive, but it's very close. And in it, I try to drill down a little bit too and touch on, there's a passage where I touch on the history of a particular place where I find myself as a young girl standing. And for the listeners, it's a poem about pleasure boating on the Kentucky River, where I learned to water ski and where lots of people ran their boats up and down, and it was very social and fun. And at one point I drill down a little bit in the history. I'm on a bank and I think about, or the poem thinks about, who else was in this spot? Well, tribal hunters made hunting caves here, which I think speaks back directly to the first set of poems. But I also drill down in terms of thinking about, but here's all the fossils from all of the ancient geology. So there's different histories that run through this place. And that's something that's very interesting to me as a poet, which is what kinds of histories, geologic history, mythological history, contemporary history, go through a place, what's there. And so this poem, I think, talks to that place, I think, and the spirit of it in conversation a little bit with the first part.
Yeah, I definitely felt that as I read it, and also a sense that here's another kind of intimate story of this great green valley, right? And So there's this sense of, especially as she stands there on that bank, the sense of time and how... And natural time, right? That also is being carved by this river. And so I think it's a really lovely way to end the poem, whole collection.
Yeah, this is the first, I haven't written a lot about my childhood, and that was new territory for me too. So I enjoyed it, and I'm very glad for it to have a home with this collection. I think it's the right place for it.
Yeah, feels like it. Well, thank you so much for mm-hmm. spending some time with us today, for sharing your poems, and I hope people will tune in again and listen to more poets and more writers from Kentucky. Thank you, Linnell, for being with us.
Thank you so much, Randy.
This is WUKY, and I'm Julie Wren. I hope you enjoyed hearing from two poets coming to our Kentucky Women Writers Conference on September 9 through 12. That conference is a program of the University of Kentucky College of Arts and Sciences and Kentucky Women Writers Conference, Incorporated. For more information, you can reach me by phone at 859-257-2874 or by email at KentuckyWomenWriters@gmail.com. My guests have been Joy Priest, author of the debut poetry collection, Horsepower, and Linnell Edwards, author of the new poetry chapbook, This Great Green Valley. I hope you enjoyed our conversations and their beautiful poetry. I'll be back in April with more Kentucky Women Writers. For WUKY, I'm Julie Wren.